are listening to the most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com.
You're listening to The Legal Help Desk with Solar Atrazadeh, only on LA Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to The Legal Help Desk. On this program, I will discuss legal principles, recent cases, and updates. Today, I will discuss online privacy and the related state and federal laws. Please bear in mind that my discussions are for general information purposes only and are not intended to create an attorney-client relationship. The law is complicated and you should consult with a qualified attorney before taking legal action. Please make sure you don't disclose confidential information during the program. And for more information about my program, visit latalkradio.com/legal.php. You can also call me on the air at 818-602-4929 to ask questions during the program. Well, that said, we're going to start by talking about online privacy. In general, privacy falls under two categories, corporate privacy and personal privacy. Corporate privacy concerns the protection of corporate data, for example, trade secrets and electronic communications, from unauthorized retrieval or interception. In general, security is important for protection of trade secrets, proprietary information, and privileged communications. The failure to maintain confidentiality can result in the loss of trade secret status. And economic espionage and theft of trade secrets are also a major concern. There is an issue of waiving the attorney-client privilege or work product protection if there is a breach of corporate privacy. Now, the Economic Espionage Act makes misappropriation of trade secrets or economic espionage a federal crime. It basically protects businesses against trade secret theft, which may benefit a foreign government. The government must prove several basically elements. One is the defendant intended to benefit a foreign government. Number two, defendant knowingly possessed trade secret information. Three, defendant knew the information was obtained without authorization. Four, the information defendant possessed was a trade secret. And finally, the defendant knew the information was a trade secret. It provides for injunctive relief in civil actions pursuant to Title 18, USC Section 1836. Now, for those who don't know what the injunctive relief is, it's basically a way to get a court order to tell the defendants to do or not to do something. Now, how do you protect corporate privacy? First, identify, label, and restrict access to confidential information. Use encryption. There are websites or companies out there that provide encryption applications like TrueCrypt and also Xantum. Use firewall and usernames and passwords with alphanumeric characters. You can use software that detects trade secrets theft. Actually, there's a company out there called Safe Corp. .biz, and I'm bringing in the CEO of this company in a few weeks as my guest. You should issue computers without hard drives. Prohibit removable storage devices, for example, flash drives. The reason is because someone can come in and just stick their flash drive into the computer or the server and take the information and walk out without any detection. We should definitely monitor and audit employee computers. We should monitor and audit web-based email services. I definitely recommend to clients to execute non-disclosure and confidentiality agreements and also execute computer use policies. These are some basic things that I definitely recommend. Now, let's talk about some laws and statutes. California has a law. It's called California Online Privacy Protection Act. It became effective on July 1st, 2004. It's basically codified under Business and Professions Code sections 22575, And it's the first state law in the nation to require commercial websites or online services to post a privacy policy. It applies to any business that collects personally identifiable information from California consumers. And any business, even if located outside California, with customers inside the state, is at risk of agency enforcement action or private litigation if it does not comply with the guidelines. A website will be in violation if it fails to post a privacy policy within 30 days after being notified of its noncompliance. Now, let's do a case study. I like to do these because it helps the audience apply basically the rules to real life scenarios. There's a case called Apple Inc. versus Superior Court. In this case, a customer filed a lawsuit against Apple for violation of the Sung-Beverly Credit Card Act, which is codified under Civil Code Section 1747.08. It prohibits merchants from requesting and recording personal identification information. On February 4, 2013, the Supreme Court of California held that the Sung-Beverly Credit Card Act does not apply to online purchases when the product is downloaded electronically. The court's rationale was because the safeguards against fraud provided in the statute, like visually inspecting the credit card, are not available to online merchants selling downloadable products. There was heavy dissent on this case by the other justices. Now, let's talk about how to protect personal privacy. I've outlined a couple of things. They're not comprehensive, but they are helpful. Always search for a privacy policy on every website that you register or provide information. I always suggest to clients to take some time to review the policy. We must bear in mind that a trustworthy privacy policy can be easily found and understood. Also, a decent website places a hyperlink to its privacy policy. Privacy seals are recent advancements and ensure that the website is complying with its privacy policy. For example, BBB Online, which is a subsidiary of the Council of Better Business Bureaus, and TrustE seals offer a handle or a way to handle consumer complaints. Always protect passwords and change them randomly. That's a good thing. And also use a secure browser that complies with industry security standards like SSL, which is Secured Socket Layer, that encrypts or scrambles data. Now, let's talk about anonymizers. Basically, what they do is they make the user anonymous by providing an untraceable alias, although they can be a useful tool for consumers. However, it can protect lawbreakers also, in other words, hackers. Actually, New York Times once wrote that technologies are morally neutral. They could be used, for example, to commit a crime or to report one anonymously. So it's a double-edged sword. Now, anonymizers, or a software application called Anonymizer, is one of the best-known and oldest products. It allows you to surf anonymously on the web. It also offers anonymous email and net access. You can go to anonymizer.com for more info. Another technology or system is called the Onion Routing System. It was originally developed with the United States Navy in mind, in order to protect government communications. Today, it's being used for other purposes by regular folks, the military, journalists, law enforcement officers, and activists. If you like, you can go to a website called epic.org for more information. Now, there is an application or a software called Tor, T-O-R. According to its website, Tor is free software and an open network that helps online users defend against traffic analysis, a form of network surveillance that threatens personal freedom and privacy, confidential business activities, and state security. Tor protects the online user by bouncing communications around a distributed network of relays run by volunteers all around the world. It prevents somebody watching your internet connection from learning what sites you visit, and it prevents the site you visit from learning your physical location. Individuals can use it for socially sensitive communications. Journalists can use it to communicate safely with whistleblowers and or dissidents. But at this time, it cannot solve all anonymity problems. It focuses on protecting the transport of data, so you may need to use protocol-specific support software if you do not want websites to view your identifying information. There's also something called infomediaries. There are two types. Type 1, like autobytel.com or bizrate.com, offer consumers a place to gather information about products and companies before they make purchasing decisions. So an infomediary is a neutral entity, a third party, a provider of unbiased information. It does not promote or try to sell specific products in preference over other products. The second type provides vendors with consumer information that will help their vendor develop and market products. It collects the buyer's personal information and markets that data to organizations. Now, just to remind you, if you have any questions, if you want to ask them all over the basically program on the air, you can call me directly at 818-602-4929. Let's continue talking about cyber safety. It's a hot topic these days, so I thought it was important to discuss it on this program. To promote cyber safety outreach and education, the FCC recently partnered with OnGuardOnline.gov, a joint effort of 12 federal agencies and 18 non-government organizations that's developed and managed by the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC. OnGuardOnline.gov provides tips to help consumers be on guard against internet fraud, securing computers, and protecting personal information. For example, some recommendations consumers should follow are: use security software that updates automatically, keep operating systems and web browsers up to date, keep passwords private and secure, and always back up important files. Those are some important tips that you should follow. Now, OnGuard online.gov features guidance, entertaining games, and quizzes on many topics. For example, phishing, social networking, laptop security, and wireless access. It also has a special section about protecting kids online. It features a new guide called NetCetera, chatting with kids about being online, quote-unquote, basically gives tips for talking to kids about risks of inappropriate conduct, contact, and content. If you think you've been a victim of online fraud or downloaded spyware or malware, contact an attorney. I cannot emphasize on this enough. You may also contact the Federal Trade Commission and file a complaint on their website or call them directly at 1-877-382-4357. In general, the FTC enters internet identity theft and other fraud-related complaints into Consumer Sentinel, which is a secure online database available to more than 1,700 civil and criminal law enforcement agencies in the U.S. and abroad. For more information, you can go to ftc.gov and obtain more information about this. Now, let's talk about personal privacy. I think it's important to know about personal privacy, especially because of what's going on the internet these days. There are several types of protection. First, the Constitution. For those who may not know, we have a federal constitution and also state constitutions. The federal constitution under the Fourth Amendment protects against unreasonable searches and seizures. The California Constitution also recognizes the right to individual privacy. Now, there are some federal statutes that do protect privacy, and they include, but they're not limited to, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, the Privacy Act of 1974, and there are also some other health and financial, basically, statutes that protect these types of information, including HIPAA. The other one is called Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, and the Fair Credit Reporting Act, or the Electronic Fund Transfer Act. There is also the common law that protects personal privacy. Recently, there was a case with Facebook. It was entitled Fraley versus Facebook. In that case, the Facebook members brought a class action lawsuit alleging misappropriation of names and or likenesses to promote products and services. At this time, the parties, basically the plaintiffs and defendant, have moved or are moving towards final approval of settlement for $20 million. The other way to basically outline and define personal privacy rights is through contract law. Privacy rights can be enforced or waived by contract, for example, through collective bargaining agreements. Company policies can create or negate a reasonable expectation of privacy in electronic communications. In general, users have a reasonable expectation of privacy in personal electronic communications, like personal emails and text messages. Let's talk about the Fourth Amendment, because I think it's an important body of law. It protects, quote-unquote, persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures. Now, let me ask you a question. Does a subscriber have an expectation of privacy in his subscriber information, which he or she may supply to the internet service provider? Well, in People v. Stipo, the defendant wanted to quash, basically get rid of, a search warrant that led to evidence showing that he hacked into a high school's computer network. Police learned his internet provider's name and applied for a search warrant to require the internet provider, in this case Time Warner, to identify the name of the subscriber with that address. Once they got Stipo's name and physical address, they obtained a search warrant to seize his computer. And the court found that Stipo did not have a legitimate expectation of privacy in the subscriber information he provided to Time Warner because he had voluntarily turned it over. Now, the California Constitution, under Article 1, Section 1, it's entitled Inalienable Rights. It basically says all people are by nature free and independent and have inalienable rights. Among these are enjoying and defending life and liberty, acquiring, possessing, and protecting property, and pursuing and obtaining safety, happiness, and privacy. It's important to know this right of privacy is limited to people, quote-unquote, meaning natural persons. So this constitutional provision does not apply to corporations or business entities. There are two types of privacy interests under the California Constitution. First, informational privacy, which is the interest in preventing distribution or abuse of sensitive or confidential information. And second, autonomy privacy, which is the interest in making intimate personal decisions or conducting personal activities without observation, intrusion, or interference. Let's do another case study. There was a case regarding personal privacy. It was entitled Doe versus City of San Francisco. This case was about two employees who alleged their personal email accounts were accessed by other employees without authorization. The employees were permitted to use Department of Emergency Communications computers during breaks to access personal emails. But one of the plaintiff's supervisors gained access to that employee's personal emails, printed them, and turned them over to human resources for review of violations. Now, the plaintiff sued the city and its employees for violations of the Federal Stored Communications Act, California's whistleblower statutes, invasion of privacy, intentional infliction of emotional distress, and several California Fair Employment and Housing Act violations relating to gender-based discrimination, sexual harassment, and retaliatory conduct. Now, the court granted the motion for summary judgment for plaintiff's second claim and denied all remaining claims. Let's quickly discuss and go over social networking privacy. The question is, what is a social networking website? In basic terms, it's an online forum that allows users to communicate and share information. What are the risks and benefits? Well, the risks could include access by marketers, job recruiters, or government agencies. Maybe there is a way for the employer to access that information from the prospective employee. In fact, in January 1, 2013, Illinois passed the Right to Privacy in Workplace Act, a law which prohibits employers from demanding social network account information. Another issue that could come up is identity theft. California has both civil statutes and penal code related to identity theft. Now, on the other side, what are the benefits? Maybe advertising and marketing. That's one way of looking at it, as a pro versus a con. And in my own terms, cyber omnipresence, meaning that you are basically available and viewable on the web at all times. A case study regarding facial recognition software. I think it's important to know because many people, including some of my clients, didn't know that there is such a software that recognizes your biometrics, basically your face, by using a specific application. In June 2012, Facebook announced the acquisition of Face.com, a facial recognition technology company. Facebook uses an automatic facial recognition system called Tag Suggestions to create a database of users' biometric information. Now, what are the issues? One, profile deletion mechanism. Basically, creating biometric profiles without consent lacks a proper profile deletion mechanism. The second issue that may come up is unauthorized access, failing to implement safeguards to protect biometric information. Okay, now let's move on. Let's talk about search engine privacy. Guess what? Search engines gather personally identifiable information from their users. That information includes search terms, time, date, and location of the computer executing the search. Now, what are the risks? One, behavioral targeting. Two, public disclosure of private information. Should search engines limit collection, retention, and disclosure of IP addresses? That's one question. Now, federal laws do not provide uniform privacy protection for personal data submitted to search engines or for IP addresses. There is a graph that you can use or download from news.com under CNET. It basically does a comparison between search engines and their privacy guidelines. For example, ask.com only retains data for maybe hours. AOL usually keeps it for 13 months. Google for about 18 months. Microsoft, 18 months. Yahoo, 13 months. Now, are these information or data deleted or anonymized? It varies. Some of them delete them, some of them keep them and do not anonymize them. Is there an opt-out basically option from behavioral targeting? Some of them provide that option to opt out, some don't. So you have to be aware of your privacy rights and responsibilities when you're using search engines. Now, we all know that the answer to many questions is usually an online search away. However, online searches are not free of consequences. Did you know that search engines can track and store a user's search history and even sell this information to others for profit? What someone types in a search bar can become part of a permanent link tied to their IP address. So naturally, at least I believe, there is a privacy concern. How do they do it? Search engines track personal information using search history, including IP addresses, search terms, name, and location that's gathered from online users. For example, Google and Yahoo can then use this information for marketing purposes. Online search history generates an impression of the user, which can be used for investigations. Also, recent surveys show that public opinion strongly disfavors this level of surveillance. So what's been the search engines' reactions? Well, they're competing to provide greater privacy protection to online users. I'll give you a hint. Go to ixquick.com. That's ixquick.com. This search engine contends and holds that it does not track or store personal information from users. You can use it and try it and see if you like it. I think it's safe to say that we have all, if most of us at least, experienced behavioral targeting or advertising. Well, what is it? Let me explain. Basically, it's collecting information about a consumer's behavior and using it to customize ads. In other words, it's use of data about a consumer to provide a service customized for that consumer. Many search engines do it. Outside the circle of the large search engines, websites like ixquick.com say that they do not record IP addresses. Businesses that use behavioral advertising track consumer activities and associate them with a particular computer or device. In general, behavioral advertisers use three approaches to collecting consumer info: cookies, spyware, and deep packet inspection. Let me give you an example for the cookie-based approach. You may visit a travel website and search for airline tickets to Hawaii. You don't purchase any tickets, but later visit latimes.com to read about sports. During your visit on LA Times, you receive an ad from an airline showing flights from Los Angeles to Hawaii. In this scenario, that travel website probably had an arrangement with a network advertiser to submit ads to visitors. The network advertiser places a cookie on your computer, which was tied to non-personally identifiable information, like a web page that you visited, the ads you've been shown, and how frequently each ad was shown. Now, because LA Times website is also part of the advertising network, when you visit latimes.com, the network advertiser's cookie identifies you as a visitor to the travel website, who is probably interested in traveling to Hawaii. It then sends the corresponding ad for flights to Hawaii. Now, what are the risks? One, not being able to safeguard private information from profilers. Two, unexpected disclosure of private information that can cause embarrassment. Three, maybe the most important one, identity theft or financial fraud. And fourth, the abuse of a consumer's profile, which ultimately permits adverse decisions against that consumer. At this time, online consumers do not have enough information to determine the potential risk of loss. In other words, they cannot make an informed decision. This is simply because we lack accurate information about the probability of the loss and the magnitude of harm. We are unable to properly assess the magnitude of loss because we don't know how much data the profilers can obtain and how the data describes our intimate details. This form of non-consensual use of information is similar to wiretapping a phone. So, in essence, we are in a bad position to decide when and how to protect ourselves from the inherent harms of behavioral targeting. Let me ask you a question. Do we expect ISPs to listen in on our web-based conversations? Probably not. In fact, we expect ISPs to serve as a pipeline of our information. When we visit a website, we expect to receive information and not be tracked or profiled. And I have to be honest here and tell you when, as an internet user, we start appreciating the nature and extent of online profiling, then we may even avoid using the internet despite its efficiency and other good things. Now, before I go into the benefits, just to quickly remind you, my name is Solar Atrazade. I'm an internet lawyer. I specialize in internet and cyberspace law. My office is in Beverly Hills, California. You can call me online on the air today by calling 818-602-4929. Now let's move ahead with the benefits of behavioral targeting. As I discussed, behavioral targeting is a method of funding the generation and delivering content on the internet. So in other words, it can connect us to old, new friends and suitable products. As Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer said, the more we know about customer behavior, the more every ad is relevant. In fact, some ISPs are trying to obtain financial benefits from behavioral advertising. In California, a class action lawsuit was filed in federal court alleging that some ISPs are using the deep packet inspection form of behavioral advertising to turn customers' data into revenue stream, even though the customers are already paying for that service. What are the applicable laws? Well, there are tort claims. Some states have used legal principles and theories such as intrusion on seclusion. It's defined as an intentional intrusion, physically or otherwise, upon the solitude or seclusion of another or his or her private affairs. It subjects the intruder to liability if the intrusion is, quote-unquote, highly offensive to a reasonable person. Some other tort claims could be public disclosure of private facts, and defamation or negligence or trespass to property can also provide remedies for consumers who fall victims of behavioral targeting. There are also some federal statutory claims, for example, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. Its goal is to prevent hackers from obtaining, altering, or destroying stored electronic communications. Also, the Wiretap Act. It's codified under Title 18 U.S. Code Sections 2510 till 2522. It protects communications in transit, plus protects against both government and private intrusion into electronic communications. In general, access requires a search warrant, and any evidence obtained in violation of the law will be excluded. Now, another body of law is called the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. It's a hybrid civil criminal law. It's codified under 18 U.S. Code Section 1030. It originally passed as a purely anti-hacker criminal statute prohibiting intentional access of a computer without authority. It limits private causes of action to situations involving impairment to the integrity or availability of data, a program, system, or information that causes loss aggregating at least $5,000 in value during a one-year period, or basically 1 year. Now, other claims or basically legal causes of action fall under the category of unjust enrichment. Plaintiffs in class action lawsuits, for example, Valentine versus Nebu Ad, have made claims under the common law theory of unjust enrichment. This legal theory or principle permits recovery when a defendant was unfairly enriched at the plaintiff's expense. So the question is, who owns the consumer data? Is it the consumer or the behavioral advertisers? In the past, obviously, some behavioral advertisers have claimed that consumers do not own the data. In fact, in Valentine versus Nebu Ad Inc., the parties settled the case and Nebu Ad has established a settlement fund of $2.41 million. For more information, you can visit nebuadsettlement.com. Now, a federal agency called the Federal Trade Commission comes into play on this topic. By passing the Federal Trade Commission Act, Congress gave the FTC power to regulate unfair and deceptive trade practices. FTC can use its authority to ensure compliance when organizations do not implement reasonable measures to protect consumer information. It can investigate organizations if they use collected data in a way that's inconsistent with privacy policies. Also, the FTC enforces the Child Online Privacy Protection Act, which is the federal statute that prohibits websites from obtaining personal information from children without parental consent. So in other words, it gives parents more control over their children's personal information. Now, COPPA, which is the body of law that I just mentioned, prohibits marketers from collecting, using, or disclosing personal information from and about children. It affects sweepstakes or promotions that are targeted towards children, and the general rule is that sponsors must obtain a parent or guardian's consent before collecting personal information, like name, address, phone number, social security, or email address. For more information, I definitely suggest you're visiting my blog at internetlawyerblog.com, specifically February 19th, 2013, and August 12th, 2013, discuss the specific issue. The FTC's self-regulatory principles are important to know about. The Federal Trade Commission recently submitted self-regulatory principles in order to guide organizations that engage in behavioral advertising. These self-regulatory principles seek to promote consumer privacy interests and to be acceptable by behavioral advertisers. The principles are meaningful disclosure, reasonable data security measures, affirmative express consent to material changes to privacy policies, and affirmative express consent before using sensitive data. Now, what is meaningful disclosure? Basically, behavioral advertisers should provide meaningful disclosures to consumers. The reasonable data security measures should be taken so that behavioral data does not fall into the wrong hands. Affirmative express consent to material changes to privacy policies should be obtained before a company uses behavioral data in a way that's different from promises made when the company collected that data. And fourth, affirmative express consent before using sensitive information should be obtained before the advertisers use that sensitive data. For example, data about children, health, or finances. There have been some proposals to increase privacy. For example, opt-in consent, which requires profilers to get your consent before collecting data. Do not track list. It's similar to a do not call list that the FTC keeps to let consumers opt out of telephone marketing. It allows consumers to avoid behavioral advertising by choice. Now, expanding COPPA, which at this time only applies to children under 13 years old, to cover all individuals, has also been proposed to increase privacy. There is a body of law that's called Do Not Track Law, also Assembly Bill 370. In September 2013, the California legislature enacted a new Do Not Track Law, again, AB 370. It amended Section 22575 of the Business and Professions Code. That's California law. That's called Business and Professions Code. It requires websites to disclose their practice of tracking consumers' personal identification information. This new law may be the first step towards universal anti-tracking standards, which will give greater protection over the internet for online users and their personal information. It's a signal to websites that political bodies are mobilizing to protect online consumer privacy. In fact, if you go to my blog, which again is internetlawyerblog.com, and if you read the November 11 issue, you'll see that we wrote an article about this new legislation. Now, under AB 370, any website that collects personal information from online users must disclose the specifics of its tracking behavior to consumers. It requires that websites inform consumers of their protocol for responding to do not track signals, in other words, DNT signals. For example, if you use Mozilla Firefox, you have the option to request that it not track your personal information. AB 370 addresses any practices that allow third parties and websites to access and use your personal information. Now, this new law requires websites to disclose whether they grant third-party access to personal information. It doesn't prohibit websites from continuing to track personal information or grant access to this information to others. It actually aims to improve disclosure standards so that consumers, like yourselves, are better informed about how their online activities can affect access to their personal information. AB 370 provides prosecutors with a greater range of regulations to implement in order to protect online privacy. So in any website that's registered in California should update its privacy policies to include the new provisions. This new law better defines online tracking, which means more protection for online consumers. It doesn't define tracking behavior, but allows individual websites to define their own tracking behavior. This expands the issue of wide enough to include all tracking information and focuses on disclosure to consumers instead of aiming to directly address consumer protections. But this may empower websites to manipulate definitions for their own gain, and it probably means increased costs for websites, which will be forced to spend time and resources to review their tracking behaviors. Now, let's talk about internet sales tax, because there is a movement towards change in this specific category. Online sales markets are in a state of expansion, basically, as more consumers continue to conduct their purchases online. We all know that the topic of internet sales tax has been in debate in the California legislature for some time now, and now with the possibility that the federal government may pass the Marketplace Fairness Act of 2013, online sales taxes could change across the country. So if you're a consumer who makes purchases online, or a business that conducts sales online, the California Internet Sales Tax provisions may apply to you. Currently, the standard tax rule in California and across America is that online retailers must collect sales tax from customers who are located in states where the online retailer maintains, quote unquote, a physical presence. So again, let me repeat that. The standard tax rule in California and basically in the United States is that online retailers must collect sales tax from customers who are located in states where the online retailer maintains a physical presence. So an online retailer maintains a physical presence in states where they have a warehouse, for example, a store, a corporate office, or a sales rep. In states where online retailers do not collect online sales tax, customers have a duty to report and pay a sales tax on their online purchases. In this case, the tax is a use tax, not a sales tax. Please bear in mind that these standards do differ between each state and for federal taxes. The federal government also has been considering the Marketplace Fairness Act of 2013, which would allow businesses to collect taxes on sales in individual states, regardless of where the seller is located. But any business that isn't physically located in a state and makes less than $1 million a year would not be required to follow this tax schedule. This new law would also require states to reform their current sales tax laws to make online sales tax collections more simple. Now, for California, this new law will not most likely make a substantial difference because the largest online sellers, like Amazon, already maintain a physical presence in California. So, in other words, California online shoppers already pay an online sales tax for most of their online purchases. People who support online sales tax argue that enforcing the sales tax will level the playing field between online and offline businesses. Also, without an online sales tax, consumers are more likely to purchase products online, which takes away revenue from offline businesses. But people who oppose such a tax explain that an online sales tax will hurt the country's overall economy, which continues to struggle. Also, the opposition argues that calculating the appropriate sales tax is difficult for online businesses simply because they have to take into account the buyer's place of purchase and respective sales tax rates, which vary. So as a practical matter, with different rates in different states, this becomes an overwhelming task for online businesses that conduct sales across the country. I think it's important to also talk about the government shutdown effects, because we went through that a couple of weeks ago, and I just want to briefly talk about it. I don't think there is any doubt that the effects of the shutdown harmed both small businesses and consumers. Specifically, the shutdown effectively halted small businesses from continuing their operations. So not being able to seek proper funding, hiring employees, pursuing growth and expansion, and seeking certifications to even continue operations, small businesses had to face consequences of an ineffective government. In fact, the government shutdown cut financial resources for small businesses. For example, banks and other financial institutions were unable to issue loans while the SBA remained closed and could not process paperwork. In addition, with IRS closing, lenders couldn't check tax information or provide funding for qualified applicants. Businesses were unable to hire new employees without access to E-Verify, which is a website that allows companies to ensure new employees can legally work. Now, any business that operated in regulated industries had to wait for government agencies to issue certifications so they can continue basically with normal business operations. For example, entrepreneurs who wanted to establish a business or expand in the agriculture industry must seek approval from the Department of Agriculture. With the department being closed during the government shutdown, some were unable to continue operations. Aside from the ability to generate business, some companies ended up losing money because of the overhead. So the uncertainty in that time was really frustrating, and I was getting many calls from clients of mine that are business owners. Small businesses were unable to conduct operations again and fulfill their orders. They were also unable to give customers an answer for when business will return to normal. During that time, my office basically had to deal with issues regarding breach of contract, lease expirations, foreclosures, and potential bankruptcies. So we had to talk about that with our clients. So how do we protect ourselves against another potential shutdown? In order to ensure that government shutdowns do not cause more harm, we should be aware of our legal rights and responsibilities. One way to protect the business from uncontrollable situations is to make sure the contract includes a provision that addresses the specific issue. For example, similar to acts of God provision. In fact, there is a provision or a clause called force majeure. In French, it means superior force. It's a provision that lets a party to suspend or terminate the performance of its obligations when circumstances beyond its control arise, making performance inadvisable, impractical, illegal, or impossible. Now, I'll briefly talk about protecting a celebrity's image in cyberspace. We may not have time to discuss it thoroughly, but I think that it's important. A celebrity is a public figure, and his image is vital and marketable quality in show business. The image is similar to intellectual property and is a product that famous persons offer into the economy, usually for profit. So we must bear in mind that other forms of intellectual property enjoy protection under patent, copyright, and trademark laws. But an image is vulnerable to all sorts of cyber attacks that can cause severe and irreparable damage. So what should a celebrity do? Well, there are several options. The options can be preventive or reactive, depending on the situation. A celebrity can prepare and prevent cyberspace threats by speaking with an attorney to establish a plan to monitor online activity and prevent harm. Acting immediately at the first sign of an attack can prevent ongoing and permanent harm to reputation. Since a famous personality's name, image, and reputation make up the underlying fame and fortune, any attack can harm the ability to work successfully in the business. But taking steps to secure reputation is especially difficult in the case of public figures. For example, First Amendment free speech protections allow for public discussions about public figures. So in essence, it may be even more difficult to bring defamation claims when the victim of offensive remarks is in the public eye. Harmful publicity can limit a celebrity's ability to find a job. A musician may face unauthorized use of his work product, especially over the internet. While some use, even though it's unauthorized, provides free online publicity, but its use can be harmful to economic viability. Leaking new music lets users to learn about the artist's new work, but it takes away from her ability to make a profit, for example. Public figures and entertainers can protect their online profiles by paying attention to the common types of threats in cyberspace. First, another person can register domain names using a famous name to protect a profit. This is called cyber squatting. In essence, someone else registers a domain name using someone's famous name to sell it in the future for a higher price. Let's bear in mind that recent cyberspace regulations are trying to prevent future abuse. I will talk about this issue and also related internet laws in future programs. We have reached the end of the program. I appreciate your time and patience, and always appreciate your calls to my law firm. Again, my name is Salar Atrazadeh, and you can call me at 310-694-3034. My website's address is atrazadeh.com. My blog is internetlawyerblog.com. And I appreciate your listening to the program. Thank you very much, and have a good day.